afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, Wednesday, February 26th. We have one agenda item. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1531A. This is a smorgasbord of issues. Would you please explain this bill to us?
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1531A is an omnibus bill that does contain a variety of changes to various provisions and different tax programs. So there is a document up in the meeting materials titled the Section Contents, and that really steps through each section by section and does a description of what the changes are. So if it sounds good to you, I can hit the high points of that and just kind of work my way down.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, so starting off with sections 1, 2, and 3 and 4 of the bill, these are related to a couple property tax exemptions for, in one case, nonprofit low income rental housing, and the other would be low income rental property housing. So there is some overlap or linkage between the two programs. But the changes, I'll start off with the changes first in sections 1 and 2. And one of the changes is making a provision that's actually in the nonprofit low-income rental housing exemption, which is in sections 3 and 4. But it's related to who can qualify for the property tax exemption. And as the name implies, it is low income. So specifying what that low income is where the changes are being made. So right now, low income to qualify for a household that's in one of these properties, it would be 60% of the area median income would be the limit on the property occupant. And the change would be, the first change that is raising that limit from 60%, that'd be the initial year, to 80% in year 2. So if the same individuals are occupying the property for a second year, their income can then move up to 80% of the area median income after that first year. Again, that's already in the nonprofit low-income rental housing, so that's adding that provision to the low-income rental housing property tax exemption. The second change, and this would apply to both of these property tax exemptions, is related again to that area median income amount, but it's linking up to changes that were made at the federal level. So for properties that receive the federal low-income housing tax credit, there was a change at the federal level that would allow that area median income amount, that 60%, to go up to 80%, so long as the overall average for the property wide is at 60%. So the idea being there, you could have one household at 70% of area median income with another that is then at 50%, so the overall average is still at 60%. So it's incorporating those changes at the federal level into both of the two property tax exemptions. So that'd be sections 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. So section 5 and 6 is the environmentally sensitive logging equipment property tax exemption. The change here is adding the term held for use throughout the statute, with the idea being here right now there's a property tax exemption for this environmentally sensitive logging equipment, and there are requirements right now on how that property is used, or if it's used for any other purposes, how much it can be used for other purposes. But the idea in the change here is to allow a property owner to continue receiving the exemption even if they don't use that property at all during the year. So if it simply sits idle, because under current statute, if that property is not used, technically it would not be available to be exempt under the property tax exemption. So that's the change in 5 and 6. Section 7 and 10, this has to do with the single unit housing property tax exemption, and it's changing, there's some statutory cleanup.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Thank you so That's much. While well, you're still on the environmentally sensitive, mm-hmm. I see that it applies to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2019. So is that when property taxes get renewed, is July, as opposed to October or January 1st or any other? Like, taxes are normally, mm-hmm. you know, a calendar year. Maybe property taxes are different because we pay them in November. So why July 1st?
Yeah, so the Representative Kenny Geyer, the property tax year does begin on July 1st, 2019. It almost works as a fiscal year for the property tax year.
Okay.
So this July.
All counties.
Yeah. So this July 1st, 2019 is technically, it's a year back. So it's almost retroactive to this most recent property tax year, the year we're in right now.
Okay. Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so the single unit housing, the change there, again, in addition to the just the conforming changes, some of the statute cleanup that was being made, is changing the deadline for the completion of this construction that would be allowed the property tax exemption. And it's just allowing that extension. Right now, there is an extension that's available for 12 months, and make that up to 24 months. So it's giving an additional 12 months. And again, this is allowing a local government that has adopted this program to provide that 24 months. It doesn't necessarily guarantee it. So it is allowing it for, in this case, it'd be for a city to allow that. Section 10A is related to the property tax deferral program, and it's simply a one-year extension of the current law sunset that's on the books right now for the property tax deferral program. General idea here is just to give a little more breathing room for the legislature bill to take this topic up in the 2021 session. Section 11 is related to refund interest calculated by the Department of Revenue. So a few years ago, there was an errant on that was included in some of the statutory changes made, and the change here in the Section 11 would be removing that on, which would then modify to some extent how tax refund interest can be made. And there is, I know there's some testimony from Department of Revenue and the meeting materials as well that gives an example of how that works. But it's going to be a pretty small subset that are actually affected by that. Sections 12 and 12A have to do with the individual development account credit, the IDA credit. This was a credit designed really to initiate people to make contributions to the individual development account program. So you get a credit for those contributions made. So it, in some ways, it's a credit that's then used to raise funds. And the change here is effectively we're moving the sunset date up by 2 years. Right now, there's a current law sunset in place. It'd move that sunset date up by 2 years. So sunset the program going forward with the understanding that it's going to be moving to more of a direct spending program to support the individual development accounts. Sections 13 and 14 have to do with two auction tax credits, the first for the film and video and then also for the opportunity grant credit. And really the change here for both of these credits is to allow a taxpayer that's purchasing one of these credits at auction to, if they haven't filed their previous year's taxes and they make a purchase of one of these credits, they could then claim that credit that they just purchased on their previous tax year's tax return, so long as they haven't filed that tax return yet. And so the example there would, if someone purchased this, say, in August or September, they could then claim that on their tax return for the previous year, so long as they've filed an extension. And it just, the idea here is to shorten the time of when someone actually can claim that credit and receive the direct benefit from it. Okay, so sections 15 through 18 and 20 have to do with the short line railroad credit. So there were a few technical and statute reference corrections. This is a new credit that was created last session during the 2019 session, and so there's a couple technical changes. Then also the credit has been reworked is probably the best way to describe this, where there are some changes in statute related to how the credit works, with the end result, or the idea with the end result being roughly the same, but changed how it's structured. So there's a new, the way the credit is set right now, there's a tier one and a tier two. That's changed, and really the only two categories that are now in place for the short line railroads is you'd have one bucket for publicly owned, and then the other bucket is all those that are not publicly owned. So rather than having this tier one, tier two distinction, you just have this publicly owned or non-publicly owned distinction. There's an additional annual credit amount limit that's put in place, equal to 700,000. That has to do in some cases of, because this tier one, tier two distinction was removed, the tier ones would then get the same benefit from the credit as the tier twos. So this additional cap then holds the credit to more or less be the same as it is under current law. There is a change to the $4 million biannual credit cap. Instead of being $4 million per biennium, it's now $2 million annual cap, being a little bit easier to administer a cap on an annual basis rather than biannually. And then the last change here to the credit has to do with how to prioritize the credit in instances where demand for the credit exceeds that $2 million annual cap. So the way that the prioritization is set up right now is first in line would be those publicly owned short lines to get the credit that they qualify for. Second after that would be the first, the way it's written right now is every short line then would get the first $250,000 of the credit that they qualify for. So if you qualify for only $100,000 worth of credit, you'd only get $100,000, but you get up to that $250,000 is kind of the minimum amount that everybody, every short line would qualify for. With the language set up where if that $250,000 exceeds the $2 million annual amount, that can then be brought down by Department of Transportation in the application process, with the idea being as you bring that $250,000 down, you try to maximize the number of short lines that will get their full credit allotment. But again, there's a number of changes in there, but really the idea is reworking the credit to more or less function in the end,
okay,
more or less the same. Section 19 is just specifying effective dates for sections 11 to 15. Section 21 is just a cross-reference correction in the corporate excise tax. There was a change in the Internal Revenue Code statute that we linked to, so it's just pointing to the right spot. Section 22, the special use fuel license fee. This is just a requirement for the Department of Transportation along with the Oregon Transportation Commission. They will biannually review this special use fuel license fee. And the special use fuel license fee, that annual review, is just the idea there is to keep the program revenue neutral. So instead of paying for, if you're using propane to power your vehicle, when you fill up, you would buy an annual license. And so it's just giving them the ability to make sure that that is still in line with what you'd buy at the pump rather than annually. The vehicle privilege tax, section 23, just that simply data sharing between Department of Revenue and DMV. Sections 24 and 26 has to do with City of Portland background checks in their in how they're administering their municipal tax collection. There is, I know City of Portland is here in the audience as well, and there's some testimony in the media materials that helps to explain why they need that change for facilitating their tax programs. And then section 27, the final one here, is related to a Department of Revenue report. It's just expanding or giving an additional 2 years for Department of Revenue report on the global intangible low tax income, or the GILTI income. And that's just following up, giving them more time to actually get the returns to come in the door before they can actually write up that report and present it to the legislature. So there you have it. There's the section 1 through 27 of the changes of the bill.
Great. Thank you very much. I would like to publicly thank Legislative Revenue Office for providing such good summaries of information for us, taking us through sometimes complicated or sometimes just not necessarily that complicated, but complex, lots of detail. So I really appreciate the materials that you provide for us, and also to the staff who makes everything available so that the audience can watch along with us if they haven't had an opportunity to see the materials posted online in advance. So thank you for all of that. I was looking at the witness registration for when this bill came up in Senate Finance and Revenue, and there are a number of people in the audience, so that if any committee members have questions or anything you'd like to discuss about any of those sections, I know there are people here who are prepared to explain anything or amplify on the explanation that was provided by LRO. I also note that there are some things in this bill that were for specific parties or interest groups, and they're not here. So I hope you don't have a question because they're not here to represent whatever the interest was. There is one person signed up already on the sheet for testimony. Tim Williams, please.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. For the record, my name is Tim Williams. I'm the executive director of Oregon Film. I just wanted to very briefly speak about Section 13, just to give people a chance to understand why it's in there and also ask any questions of us as an interested party to this bill. As some of you already know, we administer a program called the Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF. It's one of the main ways that we help retain and attract projects here in the film, television, commercial, animation, and interactive world. It was the way we administer it and the way we conduct the online auction in conjunction with the Department of Revenue was impacted by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Over the last couple of years, with the help of this committee, we've made a few adjustments to the program, which has helped strengthen it a great deal. The provision in Section 13 is one more adjustment that allows us to just make sure we solidify the market for people hopefully buying these tax credits that help us fund the program overall. And as Kyle already explained, the provision is that you can utilize the tax credit in a previous year so long as you have not filed in that previous year. So it gives us just a slightly larger market of people that may have extended their tax credits. For example, if we did the auction in September, we could market to those people that have extended their filing period to October and give them a short turnaround on buying these tax credits. So hopefully it gives us just a slightly larger market to go after in funding the OPIF system. So I just want to make sure you guys had that explanation. And if you had any questions for me about that provision, let me know.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm really interested in how the sales are going. We have IDA coming to us saying, with their particular program, which is not exactly like yours, but it's the same idea, that they're not selling out. So how are we doing on the film front?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh. Well, better than I expected. I was caught by surprise when the IDA decided they wanted to go to the general mm-hmm. fund, and they are a different program and they mm-hmm. do work in a different way. But I believe I can't speak for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, but we both eventually sold out. It took us two auctions to get there, but the first auction for both of us was fairly robust in terms of our being able to, from my point of view, attract the audience that we have been working with since 2005 on this. And I believe there actually is a little more room to grow if we needed to do that, for sure. So I was happily surprised, and also feel like with this adjustment, we're solidifying a base that's out there that helps us keep this program the way it is. Because one of my concerns about this program is, for what we do, having something that is a multiple year program, something that's 5 or 6 years, allows us to work with the projects that may come back year after year after year. So I'm trying very hard to preserve that fact, which is what this program does very well for us.
And what about the auction price? How's that maintaining?
For us, the average auction price was, I believe, 91.2 or something like that, somewhere in that. So lowering from 95 to 90, which we did in the last session, helped a great deal in terms of attract people for it to stay ahead of sort of lower interest rates. So it was higher than 90, but it wasn't as high as 95.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a moment. It's for maybe 30 seconds. Back in business. We're just checking in on time. Our members have other obligations, places to be, but there's at least one other issue that we might want a little additional clarification on. Janet Bird is in the audience. Apparently there's something you could provide some additional comments about.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and we administer the Oregon IDA initiative. I just wanted to clarify that the pricing on the IDA and film and video and HEC, we talk about it differently. So when we talk about the IDA being a 90% credit, that means that for every 90 cents or for every dollar we receive, we're offering 90 cents of state credit. Film and video and HEC are offering a premium. So when they say 91 cents, they're actually, folks are getting a $500 state tax credit for, I can't quite do the math in my head, $455 or something. So that's the difference, I think, in the marketability, is that we're asking folks to give us less than they're receiving back in benefit. I just wanted to clarify that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Bird? Thank you. And we would like just a little that additional explanation about Section 5 through 6, property tax exemption, environmentally sensitive logging equipment. Mr. Campbell, please.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Oregon Loggers. Appreciate the opportunity to clarify Sections 5 and 6. As you know, the Associated Oregon Loggers, there are nearly 800 small, often family-owned, often multi-generational businesses. So they're small family businesses. They have a lot of challenges, one of which is the equipment that they have to own and maintain. This equipment can range from $500,000 to well over $1 million. They're like mortgages for these companies. The clarification we're seeking here, actually, we thought was the original intent of the bill that was passed in 1999. I actually was representing them then and lobbied on that bill. And here is the distinction, is that under a current interpretation of the law, if you had a piece of equipment that qualified for the exemption, you used it and it qualified, that same exact piece of equipment, if you were in a position where you didn't have the work or you weren't able to put up a whole side and so equipment sat, that same piece of equipment would not be exempt for purposes of the statute. The original intent was actually for logging companies, many of which today are having the same experience, where times can be very difficult and they just don't have the work. The markets can change. There's any number of reasons why these small family businesses end up having equipment that sits. The original purpose was to remove a burden of a personal property tax expense on equipment that they're not using. And so this just clarifies that if it's exempt when it's used, it should be exempt when it has to sit. And that's the basic purpose of the amendment. And we really appreciate your consideration. Thank you. And are there any questions based on that?
Anything else? Yes, Representative Marsh.
Since you're there, yes, I have a question. how does the appraiser find out that the machinery has not been used? Are they asked to report that?
Yeah, so Chair Nathanson and Representative Marsh, the companies do provide a list of their equipment to the county assessor.
Yeah,
and they do have to speak to the use of the equipment, so the assessor does know whether equipment is used or not. And it's just in recent days that a few county assessors have begun to assess the personal property tax on that idle equipment. And so that's why we brought the issue, is so that there was clarification.
You've been looking at other sorts of farm equipment. I mean, other sorts of equipment.
That's right. I'm wondering if there's more implications there in other realms.
A similar situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Anything else? Thank you. I see no one else requesting to speak on this topic. Nothing else to cover for this public hearing. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 1531A. There's no other business before us. We're adjourned.